We're going to be looking at the very last story recounted in the book of Judges, which runs from chapter 19 through chapter 21. You're probably familiar with the saying, save the best for last, which usually implies that the best part of a thing comes at the end. For example, if you're eating a meal and the host says, we've saved the best for last, well, you can expect an amazing dessert to top off the meal. And I wish I could say that in our study of the book of Judges that we have saved the best for last, because we have not. We've actually done just the opposite. We've saved the worst for last. Now, before you get up and run out of here, before hearing the story, I want to say that the story itself is certainly an interesting one. So on that level, it will most likely hold your attention as long as I don't flub it up too terribly bad. The lessons to be learned from the story, though, are in the realm of here is what not to do. This is a very horrible example to follow. This is a bad example laid before us, not a good one. The main lesson of this final story is the same as the lesson in the previous story that we looked at last time. It's drawn from the final verse of the final chapter, Judges 21:25, which says, in those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And this story that we'll be looking at illustrates what it looks like when we live our life without God as our king and we do what is right in our own eyes rather than what is right in God's eyes. As I pointed out last time, these final chapters of the book of Judges, chapters 17 through 21, are more of appendices or an epilogue for the book, providing additional examples from Israel's history drawn from the period of time of the judges, but they're not part of the main chronology of the book. Although we don't know exactly when these events took place, we'll be looking at tonight, Bible historians believe it took place most likely in the early part of the judges' time period. All right, so verse 1 of chapter 19, our story begins this way. In those days when there was no king in Israel, a certain Levite was sojourning in the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim, who took to himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. And his concubine was unfaithful to him, and she went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah, and was there some 4 months. This is not the same Levite man who was featured in the story last time in Judges 17 and 18, although there are a number of similarities between these two guys. They're both from the same area of Israel. A concubine was a kind of second-class wife or a higher-class servant, kind of an in-between thing in that way. So she wasn't really a full wife, and she was typically a servant or a slave of her master, but she was treated much better than your normal everyday servant. Her main responsibility was to bear children for her husband or her master. The text says that this concubine, this woman, was unfaithful. Now, this usually is understood to mean that she was unfaithful to him sexually. However, the Hebrew words used here in the original language don't always mean that. And in this particular story, it probably doesn't mean that. The Septuagint, which is an ancient Jewish translation of the Old Testament into Greek, translates it this way. She was angry with him rather than unfaithful to him. And the Targum, which is an ancient Jewish translation of the Old Testament into Aramaic, translates it as, she despised him. These two translations are probably more in line with what is actually trying to be explained to us here in the ancient Hebrew. So this concubine and her master or her husband got into some kind of fight or disagreement with one another. She got upset at him in some way. We're not told what it was that she was upset with him about, but it was bad enough that she left him and she went back to her father's house to live. After some 4 months had passed, Her husband, her master, went to her father's house to reconcile with her and hopefully bring her back home. Verse 3. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and bring her back. He had with him his servant and a couple of donkeys, and she brought him into her father's house. And when the girl's father saw him, he came with joy to meet him. So you see, obviously, they still have some relationship with one another, and it appears that they're trying to reconcile, mutually agreed upon. And her father-in-law, the girl's father, made him stay, and he remained with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and spent the night there. And on the fourth day, they arose early in the morning, and he prepared to go. But the girl's father said to his son-in-law, "Strengthen your heart with a morsel of bread, and after that you may go." So the two of them sat and ate and drank together. And the girl's father said to the man, "Be pleased to spend the night and let your heart be merry." And when the man arose up to go, his father-in-law pressed him until he spent the night there again. And on the fifth day, he arose early in the morning to depart. And the girl's father said, "Strengthen your heart and wait until the day declines." So they ate, both of them. And when the man and his concubine and his servant rose up to depart, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, "Behold, now the day has waned together, waned toward evening. Please spend the night. Behold, the day draws to its close. Lodge here and let your heart be merry, and tomorrow you shall rise early in the morning for your journey and go home." But the man would not spend the night. He rose up and departed and arrived opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. He had with him a couple of saddled donkeys, and his concubine was with him. So this Levite man was delayed again and again by his father-in-law from leaving on his journey to return home again. His father-in-law kept insisting that he stay for one more meal, and then it would be too late for him to leave. So he said, "Oh, you just need to spend the night, and then you guys can leave early in the morning again." And, you know, well, this happened again and again. And finally, he insisted on leaving at the end of the fifth day, refusing to be detained any longer. Unfortunately, because he was getting such a late start, he was going to have to spend the night in one of the towns along the way. He wouldn't be able to make it all the way back to his house in one shot then. And this is what's happening now. In verse 11, it says, "When they were near Jebus, the day was nearly over, and the servant said to his master, 'Come now, let us turn aside to this city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it.' And his master said to him, 'We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who do not belong to the people of Israel, but we will pass on to Gibeah.' And he said to his young man, 'Come and let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night at Gibeah or at Ramah.' So they pressed on and went their way, and the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. And they turned aside and there to go in and spend the night at Gibeah. And he went in and sat in the open square of the city, for no one took them into his house to spend the night. So the day was nearly over when they got near the city of Jebus, and his servant suggested that they stay there for the night. The Levite man told his servant, though, he was unwilling to stay in a city of foreigners. He wanted to stay in an Israelite town instead, so they continued further until they got to the town of Gibeah, a town of the tribe of Benjamin of Israel. And they entered the town of Gibeah and parked in the middle of the town square, hoping someone would invite them to their home to stay the night." See, this was the customary way that an out-of-towner would find lodging in those days. There were no hotels like a Holiday Inn or something that you could just pull yourself into and, you know, tie your donkeys up and pay to spend the night. Instead, travelers relied on the hospitality of the local people. Well, no one stepped forward to offer them a place to stay when they first arrived there. Now, the city of Jebus was not an Israelite city at that time, although it was in the midst of Israelite territory. The Jebusites would remain in control of this city of Jebus until the time of David. David will finally conquer the city of Jebus, rename it Jerusalem, and make it the capital city of his Israelite empire. So that's just a little background on the city of Jebus that you might find of interest, that this is what would become the city of Jerusalem. But at this time, it's still controlled by the Jebusites. Well, finally, an old man coming in from working in the fields all day saw them sitting in the town square. He invited them to come and stay the night at his house. The old man was adamant that they not spend the night in the town square. It would not be safe there. And we find out why when we get to verse 21, where it says, "And they were making their hearts merry at the old man's house that evening. Behold, the men of the city, worthless fellows, surrounded the house, beating on the door, and they said to the old man, the master of the house, 'Bring out the man who came into your house, that we may know him.'" It says they wanted this man to come out so that they may know him. They are not requesting to meet the man and have a friendly chat. They are demanding that he come out so that they can have sex with him. That's what they're demanding. And so begins now the rapid spiraling descent of our story into unimagined wickedness and stupidity that takes us to the end of the book. Verse 23 says, "And the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, 'No, my brothers, do not act so wickedly, since this man has come into my house. Do not do this vile thing. Behold, here are my virgin daughter and his concubine. Let me bring them out now. Violate them and do with them what seems best to you. But against this man, do not do this outrageous thing.'" Hopefully your circuits are already beginning to short a little bit. Otherwise, you're more messed up than I ever imagined you are. This old man, he feels so obligated, apparently, to provide proper hospitality to this man staying the night with him, that he's willing to sacrifice his own daughter and the man's concubine slash wife, offering them to this mob of men. I struggle with what to say about this. This whole thing is very messed up. This mob was terrifying, obviously, but the thinking of this old man was very twisted too in his approach on how he's going to try to pacify them. There were other choices he could have made. But this is what it looks like in those days when there is no king and everyone does what is right in their own eyes. Verse 25. "But the men would not listen to him. So the man seized his concubine and made her go out to them. And they knew her and abused her all night until the morning. And as the dawn began to break, they let her go. And as morning appeared, the woman came and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was until it was light." Well, the choice of this man pushing his concubine out the door for these animals to rape and abuse her is also unbelievable. When this mob is finally done with her and they let her go in the early morning hours, she manages somehow to drag herself back to the house where her master is staying. In verse 27, it says, "And her master rose up in the morning, and when he opened the door of the house and went out to go on his way, behold, there was his concubine lying at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. And he said to her, 'Get up, let us be going.' But there was no answer. Then he put her on his donkey, and the man rose up and went away to his home." So when he opens the door of the house to continue on his journey, he finds his concubine lying dead in the doorway of the house. And he puts her lifeless body on his donkey, and he heads for his home. 29, "And when he entered his house, he took a knife, and taking hold of his concubine, he divided her limb by limb into 12 pieces and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. And all who saw It said, such a thing has never happened or been seen from the day that the people of Israel came up out of the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, take counsel and speak. So when he gets home, he cuts her body up into 12 pieces. He sends a piece to each of the 12 tribes of Israel. And as you can imagine, this gets everyone's attention. And everyone wants to know what is the meaning of this and how did this horrible thing happen. Then all the people of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba, including the land of Gilead, and the congregation assembled as one man to the Lord at Mizpah. And the chiefs of all the people of all the tribes of Israel presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 men on foot that drew the sword. Now the people of Benjamin heard that the people of Israel had gone up to Mizpah, and the people of Israel said, tell us, how did this evil happen? And the Levite, the husband of the woman who was murdered, answered and said, I came to Gibeah that belongs to Benjamin, I and my concubine, to spend the night. And the leaders of Gibeah rose against me and surrounded the house against me by night. They meant to kill me, and they violated my concubine, and she is dead. So I took hold of my concubine and cut her in pieces and sent her throughout all the country of the inheritance of Israel, for they have committed abomination and outrage in Israel. Behold, you people of Israel, all of you, give your advice and counsel here. So people from one end of Israel to the other come and gather at the town of Mizpah, which is about 8 miles up the road from Gibeah, where the awful events of that night had taken place. And then the man recounts what happened. And I want us to note that both the town of Gibeah, where the rape and murder of this woman took place, and the town of Mizpah, where this meeting is taking place, are towns of the tribe of Benjamin. And the tribes of Israel sent men through all the tribe of Benjamin, saying, what evil is this that has taken place among us? Now therefore, give up the men, the worthless fellows in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and purge evil from Israel. But the Benjamites would not listen to the voice of their brothers, the people of Israel. So the other tribes, they demand that Benjamin hand over these wicked men in Gibeah who have done this terrible thing so they can put them to death and purge Israel of this evil. But Benjamin refuses to hand them over. Instead, they gather their fighting forces of some 26,000 men inside of Gibeah to face the other tribes in war, who have an army of some 400,000 men standing at the ready. Well, why did Benjamin choose to do this? I don't know. Why have they chosen to defend these wicked men? I don't know. They should have executed these men before the other tribes even had a chance to ask them to turn them over. Instead, they choose to put their whole tribe behind defending these animals. It makes no good sense. But this is what it was like when there was no king in Israel and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. In the interest of time, I'm not going to read the rest of chapter 20, verses 18 through 48. We're going to summarize the story that's told there for you. But so here we are. Israel's forces of 400,000 men are parked outside of Gibeah in the territory there against Benjamin's forces, which have all gone and they're inside the town of Gibeah, 26,000 men. On the first day of battle, Israel suffered terrible loss. 22,000 of their men were killed by the tribe of Benjamin that day. Benjamin suffered minimal losses. Then on the second day of battle, Israel again suffered terrible loss. 18,000 men of theirs were killed. Benjamin had minimal losses. Israel decided to change their tactics for the third day of battle, because obviously what they were doing wasn't working out very well. Instead of making a straight frontal assault against Gibeah like the first 2 days, they had a portion of their army go around the back behind the town and hide in ambush. The rest of the army then approached Gibeah from the front as before. Benjamin's army came out to meet Israel's frontal assault as they had before. The Israelite army, though, they kept falling back as Benjamin advanced against them, and the Benjamite army was drawn further and further out from the town. The Benjamites were thinking that they were going to easily defeat the Israelite army this day, just as they had the first 2 days, so they send their full force after them. But as they're pursuing and pushing against the Israelite army, the Israelite forces that had been hiding, they came and entered Gibeah, which is now undefended now, and they killed everyone inside. And then they set the place on fire. When the army of Benjamin looked behind and saw the smoke rising up from the town of Gibeah, they knew they had been tricked. And the Israelite army then attacked them from both the front and the rear and destroyed them. The entire army of Benjamin was killed except for 600 men who managed to escape to a stronghold called the Rock of Rimmon. The Israelite army then went throughout Benjamin's territory and slaughtered every man, woman, child, and domesticated animal and burned every town to the ground throughout Benjamin. When the massacre was over, the only people still alive from the tribe of Benjamin were the 600 men barricaded at the Rock of Rimmon. Unbelievable slaughter. Well, once the Israelites had calmed down and gathered their army back together, they realized what they had just done, that they have wiped out an entire tribe of their own people. So these geniuses then start discussing how they're going to rebuild the tribe of Benjamin. And they decide that their first order of business is to provide wives for each of these 600 Benjamite men who are still alive. See, you know, they're going to have to make more Benjamins. And the only way to do that is to get a lady for each of these Benjamite guys. There's a problem, though. Before they had gone to war against Benjamin, all of these Israelite men had taken an oath to not give any of their daughters in marriage to a man of Benjamin. None of these men wanted to break their oath. Wiping out an entire tribe of people is one thing, but breaking my oath is an entirely different issue when it means I have to give one of my daughters to a Benjamite man. Now, to understand just how absurd this is, I want to remind us that many of these same men who are clinging so tightly to this stupid oath that they made, they've already broken similar oaths many times that they have made to the Lord. They had promised to never give their daughters in marriage to the pagan peoples around them, but they have done that already, intermarrying with the pagan peoples around them again and again. So why all of a sudden are they going to be, you know, I'm never going to break my oath type of guys when they've been breaking oaths all along until now? Well, as they say, where there's a will, there's a way. And they came up with a solution. It went like this. See, they had taken another oath when they had first gathered together against Benjamin, that anyone who didn't join in the war against Benjamin was to be put to death. And it was discovered that the people of the town of Jabesh-Gilead had not shown up for the battle. So they decide that they're going to kill everyone in the town of Jabesh-Gilead, according to the oath that they've made, except for any young virgin women that they find there, who they will preserve and give to the Benjamite men as wives. I'm not making this stuff up, you guys. So that's what they do. They assemble an attack force. They march into Jabesh-Gilead. They slaughter every man, woman, and child in that town, except for any young virgin women that they found. A total of 400 wives for the Benjamite men were collected from the remains of Jabesh-Gilead. Well, there's another problem now, see. There are 600 men needing wives, and they've only got 400 wives collected. They're 200 wives short. What are they going to do? How do they solve this problem? Well, never fear. Because there's a lot of really smart people in this group. So in verse 13... make sure I don't lose track of my place here. Verse 13 of chapter 21 says, "Then the whole congregation sent word to the people of Benjamin who were at the rock of Rimmon and proclaimed peace to them. And Benjamin returned at that time, and they gave them the women whom they had saved alive of the women of Jabesh-Gilead. But they were not enough for them. They were 200 short, as I said. And the people had compassion on Benjamin because the Lord had made a breach in the tribes of Israel." I want to stop right there for a minute and call our attention to a couple of things in verse 15. First, it says, the people had compassion on Benjamin. Really? This is what compassion looks like. Leaving 600 men alive after slaughtering over 100,000 men, women, and children. Leaving 400 young women alive after slaughtering an entire town of men, women, and children. I think these people need to look up what the word compassion means. There's a little bit of a disconnect going on here. Second, it says the people had compassion on Benjamin because the Lord made a breach or a gap or a hole or a void in the tribes of Israel. Really? This was the Lord's doing? This is His fault? He's the one who did all of this? I'm sensing some gigantic blame shifting going on here. This is what happens when we don't follow the Lord as our King and we all do what's right in our own eyes. Well, here's their new plan for getting the additional 200 wives that they need for the men of Benjamin. They tell the Benjamite men that during the annual feast at Shiloh, which is coming right up, they're to sneak in and kidnap any young virgin woman that they see, and they can take her back to their home and she'll be his wife. Just steal someone while we're all just dancing around and having a celebration. See, the genius behind this plan is that it will prevent any of the Israelites from breaking their oath to not give their daughters in marriage to the men of Benjamin, since their daughter will be kidnapped. They won't have voluntarily given her. Well, what a great plan. I mean, these guys make Albert Einstein look like an earthworm, don't they? So in verse 23, it says, "And the people of Benjamin did so and took their wives, according to their number, from the dancers whom they carried off. Then they went in return to their inheritance and rebuilt the towns and lived in them. And the people of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family. And they went out from there, every man to his inheritance." So everyone went home feeling good about the great work that they have accomplished, saving the tribe of Benjamin from extinction. Good work, men. Put that one in the books. And finally, the last verse, it says, "In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." And this is the encompassing thought that explains all of this lunacy that we have read about in this story. 2 points of application for us are same as last time. One is, Jesus is our king. Let's follow our king's leadership. Second, let's choose to do what's right in God's eyes rather than what's right in our own eyes. Proverbs 3, 5, and 6 says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight."